County DSS. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
No, sir.
Okay. I guess not. What am I thinking? Not much to rebut. It's been a long day, Mr. Elkin.
Yes, sir. I understand. It's been a long month so far.
You can proceed when you're ready.
Well, I would like to express my appreciation for allowing me to do this by telephone conference. I'm a solo practitioner, and sometimes juggling your docket and your schedule is very difficult, so I appreciate that very much. As the court is aware that this is an appeal from the Wise County Juvenile and Domestic Relations District Court, where an order was entered finding involuntarily terminating the appellant's rights, parental rights to her child. And the appellant noted an appeal on May 2nd, 2016, and she at that time she had an attorney, Brent Fleming. I was not the attorney. I was appointed later to represent her. On May 13, 2016, the deputy clerk for the Wise County JNDR Court submitted an appeal case transmittal form, which is part of the appendix on page 1, noting on the backup form that the trial date was to be set by the Wise County Circuit Court. It's customary here in this area that you don't get a date to show up in court when you appeal something for that the judge's secretary or clerk, deputy clerk, schedules to coordinate that date with opposing counsel, and then it's sent out. She did that. The notice of a hearing was set for on June 16th. The notice of a hearing and appeal of the matter was issued by Bill Michelle, the deputy clerk for the Wise County Circuit Court, setting a hearing date for July 29th, and that is in appendix page 19. However, this notice was not served on the appellant. It was actually sent to her attorney and the other opposing attorneys. On June 30th of 2016, the appellant's attorney, Brent Fleming, requested service of process on his client, Ms. Tamara Gilmert. And on July 6, 2016, service was attempted at the address and return filed with the court with no service indicated that the defendant does not live at that address. In recognizing that the appellant yes, sir.
This is Judge Russell.
Yes, sir.
Now, if I understand it correctly, the attorney asked that his own client, who was the appealing party, be served. That is correct.
That's the way I understood it, too, yes, sir.
Given that she's the appealing party, is there any rule that requires that she be served?
Well, I don't know of any rule, but I do know fundamental fairness and due process would require that she be notified of the date and time for her hearing that was set. She was not notified when she noted her appeal. And there's no evidence that anyone ever sent a letter to her or anything like that notifying her of the date.
But traditionally we're worried about the party against whom some action or appeal is being taken, having that action or appeal taken against them without them having any notice of it. Definitionally, she has notice of her own appeal, doesn't she?
She has notice that she'd filed an appeal, but also on that notice they tell her that she will be contacted and given a trial date by the circuit court, as indicated on the back of the transmittal form. It says the date to be set later by the court. Now, when the deputy clerk set the date, she does not send out notice to the parties. She sends out notice to their attorneys, as indicated on that exhibit.
Mr. Elkins, does the record indicate anywhere that the trial attorney objected to any of the actions of the trial court or requested a continuance in order to contact or locate his client?
The court order, titled Order Withdrawing Appeal on page 32 of the appendix, indicates that the counsel for the appellant objected to the department's motion.
I understand that, but is there anything to indicate that he objected or that he requested a continuance or objected to any action being taken without his client being present?
The only thing in the transcript of the hearing is that counsel for the appellant says, "Are you sure service has been made?" And there's no evidence that he objected or said anything other than that. No, sir.
Is that sufficient to preserve any of the assignments of error that you've raised?
Well, I think as we were responded in a reply brief that, you know, he did allow the court, and the court indicated in its order that they objected to the motion to consider the appeal withdrawn, and that he never relinquished that or did anything that would indicate that he relinquished to that objection. Did he specifically reference each of those? The record does not reflect that. No, sir, it doesn't.
Let me ask you even a more fundamental question. All three of your assignments of error say that the trial court committed reversible error by terminating the residual parental rights of the appellant. All three are prefaced with that phrase. But according to the order, the circuit court did not terminate the parental rights. All the circuit court did was dismiss the appeal and remand it back to the J&D court. So have you raised issues that address an action that the trial court never took?
Well, I'm looking at the record of the transcript, which is page 4 of the transcript of the hearing, and the court says that I make the finding that the department has tried to reach the parties. I'm only too glad to dismiss the case and find the same as the juvenile court.
But that's not what the order says.
It isn't. It also is interesting that the order reflects that the court found it's in the best interest of the child, but the transcript, when asked the judge to do it, I will make that finding. It says, are we in the best interest of the child? The judge says, no contact for 6 months. So I wasn't present. I'm only going by what I have before me. But it's very interesting as to what the transcript reflects and what the order reflects.
And the objection made at trial, which is an objection to considering the proceeding under 16.1-1081D, withdrawing the appeal. That's the objection, but you haven't challenged the court's authority or the correctness of the court's action in considering the appeal withdrawn.
No, sir. I think the court does have authority to do that under the statute. The question is, did they comply with the notions of fundamental fairness and due process by not notifying the appellate that was the trial date?
Does the appellant have to be there in a termination of parental rights case where she's represented by a lawyer?
I think fundamental fairness and due process requires that she be notified that's the hearing date, and it's up to her to decide whether she comes or not.
Why didn't her lawyer notify her?
I don't know the answer to that question except for the fact that at least on two occasions he tried to notify her by having her served, and that service was returned not found.
Why isn't notice to the attorney sufficient notice?
Because the attorney may or may not have the ability to be in touch with his client. I've practiced for 27 years, and I can tell you that quite often our efforts to get in touch with our client, the numbers we have or the address we have, is fluid, and it's not always...
But isn't the proper remedy there for the trial lawyer to say, well, Judge, I haven't been able to contact my client. I'd like a continuance and an opportunity to locate him or her?
Well, I certainly would hope I would do that. Yes, sir.
I understand you weren't the trial lawyer.
Yes, sir.
All right, go ahead.
You know, and all those factors considered, you know, the question becomes, is she entitled to notice on the appeal to the circuit court? And, you know, I grant you that if she was given a date to appear for the trial to be set or for the actual hearing when she noted her appeal and she didn't show, then I think that's all that was required. But in this district, our proceedings in this court, you do not get a notice to come. The clerk sets that date later. And no notice was ever issued to her, and therefore she didn't know that she needed to appear on that date, and it's trial de novo, and your opportunity to go through and have the Department of Social Services present their evidence and your opportunity to present your evidence with regard to the case. also, and I think in my third argument about whether there was sufficient evidence presented to the court to make a finding that under 16.1-283C, all the Paul Adams, the officer or the social worker, ever testified to was he'd had one contact with her in the last year. And so we argue that that in itself is insufficient to make a finding under that particular code. Although the court's order says order withdrawing appeal, it does make reference to further evidence being heard and a subsequent decision that they make a finding that that the appellant failed to maintain continuing contact with and to provide or substantially plan for the future of the child for a period of 6 months after the child's placement in foster care, notwithstanding reasonable efforts. You know, under that section, you have to show that it's in the best interest of the child to do so, and those sections. In the transcript, the attorney for the social services asked the court, best interest of the child, and the court says, no, failure to 6 months, I think is how the court phrased it. So it's interesting, but it did, you know, this is a fundamental liberty interest, the right to have your relationship with your child, and fundamental fairness and due process is something we all learn in our first week of constitutional law, concepts we learn, and that, you know, notice and opportunity to be heard is a part of those theories.
Well, she had notice and opportunity to be heard when the proceeding was initiated in the J&D court.
That is correct.
So it's not a notice case. It's a question of whether due process requires her to be notified a second time of the trial date when she's represented by counsel who has notice of the trial date.
I would not disagree with that.
All right. Anything further?
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much for your argument, and we're glad you don't have a four-hour drive from Lexington ahead of you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that, too.
Okay.